potentially solving a cold case should never be a sad or depressing event.
This is Kurt Rants, the official closing episode of each week-long case covered in meticulous detail by the Veritas 7 True Crime Podcast, with your host, Kurt Dillon.
This podcast is like nothing else out there. Yeah, it's true crime, but we don't present it in a morose or moribund kind of way.
The Veritas 7 features the most interactive and immersive true crime podcasting experience ever imagined.
Our whole goal is engagement with our audience, and that's before, during, and after we're recording each show. The whole purpose of this show is to try and actually solve these crimes. This is the only true crime podcast I've ever heard of where the audience can actually help try and solve the crime.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, so you'll know right away when each new episode goes live.
And we are all about trying to solve these crimes. Everyone on our staff is dedicated to uncovering the truth. That's where the name Veritas comes from.
And now, let's get into the action. Take it away, Kurt.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome, everybody, and thank you for joining me, your host, Kurt Dillon, for this, the inaugural episode of Kurt Rants, the official closeout show of each case that we're going to highlight. Tonight, we are going to be highlighting and closing out the Alphabet Murders. So this is going to be my last review of the evidence, the suspects, the victims, the case as a whole, as we close it out and put our investigation to bed and look forward to greener pastures and hopefully eventually a conviction in the case. So you don't want to miss it. Sit back and stand by, because Veritas means truth, and the truth starts now. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining me, your host, Kurt Dillon, for this, the episode of Kurt Rants, where we officially are going to close out the case of the Alphabet Murders. Been a long ride on this case. We've definitely delved into a lot of the idiosyncrasies of it. We've seen, as the evidence reports, a lot of bad investigative work that was done in this case. Also, the resistance of the current authorities that are handling the case to still reveal what evidence they feel they're holding on to that they're going to need to identify the perpetrator of these crimes more than 50 years after the fact. The bottom line is, in this case, you know, these girls were killed in, you know, horrible fashion. And try as I might to grasp the coincidence that they were all selected and killed because of their names, I can't get there. In this case, there's no evidence. And in the end, while as tantalizing as a morsel of sensationalism might be, the bottom line remains that it's an evidence-based system of justice that we have. Taking that into account, we have to know before we can make an assumption as to why or a motive for a crime. We have to have some sort of evidence that points in that direction. And there is no evidence in this case that anybody could have known enough about these girls to know their first and last names and their whereabouts on any given day to have been able to systematically isolate them, pick them out, choose them, stalk them, you know, basically case their movements and their lives with the abject goal of abducting them and committing these horrible crimes just because their names all started with the same initials. Again, like I said, try as I might, I just can't get there. I can't get there. And, you know, it is a compelling piece of fact that they all have similar initials. And while it's much easier to understand how somebody like Joseph Nasso, the one suspect that we dossiered in this case, how somebody like him would be able to isolate sex workers and identify them and carry out, you know, his barbaric plans with each of them. It's a lot different when you're talking about an adult than it is when you're talking about a child. Children just don't walk around with ID. They don't identify themselves wherever they go like adults do. if you work in a place, it's very possible you deal with people, even if you're working the customer service counter at your local grocery store, you're going to deal with a lot of people's first and last names. That's not the case with children that are 10 and 11 years old. It takes a very special kind of relationship with a child of that age to be able to know, again, first of all, what their first and last names are, and secondly, to know their movements, when they're not going to be home, when they're going to be out running errands for their parents. And this is the reason why I had posited the theory earlier in the investigation that if the alphabet name, you know, if the dual name phenomenon was actually a relevant element of this case, then by necessity, the killer has to know all three families. And by necessity, the killer has to have inside information on the movements inside the families, which the only thing that lends itself to me, since we know the girls didn't go to the same church, we know the girls didn't go to the same school, we know all of those things to be fact. We know they didn't go to the same clubs, they didn't have the money, the families didn't have the money to go to clubs. They didn't participate in any kind of like after school activities like sports or anything like that. So there's no way that these girls knew each other or that a killer that was associated with any of their common places would have been able to identify them and track them the way that they were. The only thing that leaves any sense to me, if it's an even remote possibility, would be somebody that worked for social services. Since all three families were on public assistance, somebody that worked for the Department of Human Services there in Rochester back in the early 70s could have very easily gotten access to their case files and learned their names, their addresses, and so forth. And it wouldn't have taken that much creativity back in the early 70s to case the houses and watch the movements of the children. Although you would have to have, during the middle of the day, you would presume they would be at work at the Department of Human Resources. So to not be there, to be able to have the time to case these children, I mean, is it possible? I guess on the outlying, there's an outlying fringe possibility that, you know, the person, they didn't have remote workers back then. These case agents do have to do field work and they do have to observe. So it's possible that if it was an actual field agent that committed the crimes, that they used the premise or the guise of surveilling the family and the family dynamic to be able to case the individual homes of these girls and carry out their dastardly deeds that way. But again, I think that's a pretty far stretch. And if you're going to believe that, you also have to believe that they are the ones that were responsible for killing Carmen as well, 18 months prior to the death of Wanda. And again, that begs and opens up the door to all kinds of other scenarios and situations and questions. It actually evokes more questions than it answers, because it tells us that this person did what they did to Carmen in the way that they did it, face to face, leaving her undressed, letting her escape and have her run halfway down the road, flailing her arms. And then we're supposed to believe that they waited a full year and a half before deciding to do the same thing to Wanda Walkowitz. And then after the incident with Wanda Walkowitz, they waited another 6 months before Michelle Mayenza. And then were to believe suddenly stopped of their own volition. It just seems very odd to me, that timeline. It's too sporadic. There's nothing patternous about it. And these killers, it's almost unheard of for such a depraved killer to be able to control the impulse to kill and to rape, especially children, for a year and a half in between incidents. So if we're going to say that one person did this, we also have to say that something happened that prevented him from targeting any other victims for that intervening 18-month gap there. And probably something else intervened that kept him from acting on his impulses in the 6-month interval between Wanda Walkowitz and Michelle Mayenza. I still can't get there. I look at this case and I say to myself, I can't imagine a scenario where this wouldn't have been looked into, although nothing in the FOIA materials that we got on this case showed any real interviews with anybody that works for the Department of Human Resources or the Department of Social Services there in Rochester back then. So I don't know if this detail eluded them. I know the media sensationalism in this case at the time had a lot to do with it, had a lot to do with the way the case was investigated, particularly in as far as wanting to talk about the Agatha Christie novel that supposedly these victims were selected to pay homage to in some way. But again, I don't see it. I really believe, just as you heard in episode 6 and the verdict of our Prime case, I believe that Carmen was in fact killed by her uncle Miguel, who I also believe the evidence points to as being the primary candidate for her prolonged sexual abuse. But again, we'll never know these things because they're all, everybody that's involved directly is dead. Everybody that has direct knowledge is dead. So while we're speculating, or while I'm speculating now, that's all anybody will ever be able to do as far as the prolonged sexual abuse that Carmen endured, because again, there's just nobody else around that has firsthand knowledge. So I am convinced with the evidence at hand from the witness testimonies, which is another thing, the witness testimonies of that all claim that they saw Carmen running on the side of the road, flailing her arms that night. A lot of the details that they gave, we can't lend credence to. The one out of the 100+ that said that they saw a woman get out of the passenger side of the car, we can't put much stock in that. We just can't. Even the fact that there were two people that were in the car, apparently, according to multiple witnesses, but still nowhere near a majority of the witnesses. So can we definitively say that we know that there were two people in that car? We can't. The main issue to me, as far as that element of this case, of Carmen's case, is concerned, is because of the type of vehicle. There's no evidence that Carmen's uncle had access to a large luxury vehicle like a Cadillac or a Ford LTD, as has been reported. But that also doesn't mean he couldn't have had access to one either. So we take that with a grain of salt, and we have to believe and put credence in that piece of evidence because it's almost unanimous that everybody that saw the incident that passed by that night agrees that it was a large full-size sedan. And the odds of that many people confusing a Pinto with a Cadillac are pretty slim and none if you look on our website and you see the photos of what a Pinto of that era looked like versus what a Cadillac of that era looked like, where a Cadillac back then was basically a rolling living room. They didn't make small cars back in the early 70s. A Cadillac was a huge car, and there's just no way that anybody was going to convince that or confuse that large-sized Cadillac with a Pinto. Which, of course, we know is the vehicle that Carmen's uncle owned. That being said, I also believe that there is some evidence that was put into the case that would tend to implicate Carmen's uncle that we also have to discredit. Things like his having washed the car with some kind of highly efficacious cleaning compound that raised a big stink. Again, we know from the evidence that Carmen wasn't stabbed, she wasn't shot, she was scratched with human fingernails all over her body, but none of that would cause her to bleed significantly. Also, the back area of a Pinto is relatively small. If you've ever been in one, or if you look at the photos on our website, you'll see the idea of actually having attacked her in the back of that car, in the luggage compartment specifically, which is where the cleaning solutions were used to clean the back of the car. There would just be no reason to do that. The girl wasn't bleeding. So cleaning the cargo area of the car with any kind of real heavy cleaning agents just doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense. The only other thing that I could think of as I delved into what would possibly cause the killer, if the killer, you know, had that car, what would possibly cause them to clean the back of the car as well as they did would be if there was reason to believe that Carmen maybe couldn't hold her urine or couldn't hold her stool and either urinated or defecated in the back of the car while she was being attacked in the luggage compartment, or possibly after she was dead and she was put back there, that maybe her body evacuated whatever it had in it. And the owner of the vehicle had to get rid of the smell of it and any trace of it. That's the only explanation that I could come up with as to why the back of that car would have to be cleaned as fastidiously as it was. But again, none of that leads itself to the premise that her body was thrown from the car while it was moving, which is what the original police reports had declared. Then moving on to the cases of Wanda Walkowitz and Michelle Mayenza. Again, we have to say we know now that they were killed by the same person. It had to be somebody who was there. It had to be somebody that had proximity and knowledge. And Theodore F. Given absolutely fits that profile. Now, is there any hard evidence that links him to their deaths? Well, if they don't test the DNA against Theodore Givens, then no. There's not going to be any hard evidence that's going to convict him. But you know what? There are many cases and many precedents in the legal system that show that people have been convicted of murders based on circumstantial evidence. Key in that, look at the case of Scott Peterson out in California, where he was convicted and actually sentenced to death for the murders not only of his wife, Lacey Peterson, but also of their unborn child, Connor Peterson. So it is very possible to convict somebody without having physical evidence and doing it based on circumstantial evidence. And I believe that if there's going to be any valid progress in the prosecution of the killer of Michelle Mayenza and Wanda Walkowitz, that Theodore F. Given holds the key to that investigation. And I strongly, strongly believe that the police in the area, the authorities, should look more closely into Given. They've gone out of their way in their case files to talk about how many people they've interviewed and how many people they've exonerated. But there is no mention of them ever interviewing or seriously considering Mr. Given as being the perpetrator of these crimes. And I think that's unfortunate. Again, in closing, I believe that there is substantial circumstantial evidence enough to gain possibly a posthumous indictment on Miguel Colon, Carmen's uncle, as her killer. And I also believe that there is enough, not at the present time, to actually indict Mr. Given, but there's definitely enough at the present time to get a court order to order his DNA and to compare it against the DNA sample that was found on the body of Michelle Mayenza. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this episode of the Veritas 7's presentation. We hope you enjoyed it. You definitely want to look for our Gifted Insights episode pertaining to this case, as well as our Uncensored episode pertaining to this case. Again, Gifted Insights episodes are all featuring our amazing psychic, so you definitely don't want to miss a single episode of Gifted Insights, and you'd certainly want to keep on the lookout for the Prime episodes when it comes to this and all of our other cases. That's the meat of our entire investigation. 6 chapters ranging from victimology to the verdict. We go over every step of the case and break it down for you in a way that hopefully can lead to our nomination for an indictment against a specific suspect or suspects. So again, nobody does it quite the way we do. We hope you enjoy the way we present it to you. We also want to encourage everybody to go and join our Facebook discussion group so that you can get in the conversation and weigh in on the verdict. We are all about interactivity here. It is facebook.com/groups/TheVeritas7. Quick reminder, if you like the content and you enjoy the show, please, please remember to rate the show, like it, and subscribe to it. Those metrics, you know, they only take a couple of seconds on your part, but they really mean a lot to us. So please, if you like the show, remember to take a minute or two and go and rate, like, and subscribe to the show. It really means a lot to us. For all of us here at the Veritas 7, thank you for tuning in. We really appreciate you. This show is all about you. Have a great night. God bless. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. So turn the car around and leave. Meet me underneath the tree inside the valley that we made. With our hands we'll make the best of the life that we have left. We will never say goodbye. Oh my love, won't you come and walk with me a while? Time don't stop.
tree inside the valley that we made. And with our hands we'll make the best of the life that we have left. And we will never say goodbye. And if we do, we'll meet again, knowing love was heaven sent. And I've never felt this way.